are not apparently blind or deaf, but they are indeed blind and deaf, because it is not the outward eyes which become blind, but it is their hearts which lose their insight. The holy verse continues saying, فَإِنَّهَا لَا تَعْمَى الْأَبْصَارِ وَلَكِنْ تَعْمَى الْقُلُوبُ الَّتِي فِي الصُّدُورِ. Verily, blind are not the eyes, but blind are the hearts which are in the breasts. In fact, those who lose their apparent eyes are not blind, and sometimes they are more enlightened people who are more aware than others, and we have clearly seen examples throughout our lives. The true blind are those whose hearts are blind and do not perceive the truth. The Holy Prophet has said in a tradition, the worst blindness is the blindness of the heart. And he also has said, the utmost blindness of the blindness is the blindness of the heart.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insight into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So this verse is exactly mentioning the means that man is provided with for understanding the truth. At first, it is the eyes and the ears. And second, it is intellect and mind. In this matter, the Prophet ﷺ has said, when Allah intends to do a favor to a servant, He causes the eye of his heart to open, by which he can see whatever was concealed to him. We know that man's heart is merely a pump for circulation of the blood. But the question is, how have the hearts in the breasts been attributed to comprehending the facts? The answer to this question has been explained vastly in the books of Al-Mizan and also Tafsir Nimuna. But shortly explained, we have to start from the meaning of the Quranic word Qalb. Since one of the meanings of this word is wisdom, and one of the meanings of the Arabic word Sadr, or chest, in the Holy Quran, is the essence and nature of man. And the heart is the symbol of man's affections. Whenever something of affections, which is often the origin of movement, appears in the spirit of man, its first effect is seen on his heart. The heartbeat changes, the blood reaches all parts and particles of the body, which gives it a new joy and power. So, when the spiritual moods are attributed to the heart, it is because their first place of appearance in the man's body is his heart. And it is interesting that in this verse, all man's perceptions have been attributed to the heart and ears. And this implies that for comprehending the facts, there are only two ways. Either man must have something from his own, and in his own spirit, by which he personally analyzes the matters and gets necessary results, or he should listen to the advice of the kind advisors, the guides of the way, the divine prophets, and the man of truth, or he can utilize both of them to obtain the facts. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. And in this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise the children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Rai Shahri. And we have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear sister.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for inviting me over.
Thank you so much for being here. So, in our previous discussions, we began with this question, stating that what are the common mistakes that parents usually do when upbringing their children? And you mentioned some, one of them being that we make them too dependent on us sometimes.
That's right. See, these are so innocent things, yeah? But yeah. We forego them. We don't know that they're really, hamper the child in the long run.
Exactly.
Another thing that often mistakenly happens is that not being careful with the spouse in front of the children.
Mm.
When you quarrel, for example, it's natural for couples to have occasional arguments, of course, and sometimes even it tends up to be heated and bitter arguments. But it's very damaging to carry out in front of the children.
Yeah.
It's very important. Because children do not understand this relationship too much. So it's they don't even understand. It's not a cause of worry. You know what I mean?
They're
natural arguments. But children don't understand that this is like something very...
Maybe not so big, you know.
But they feel that it's a very big thing.
Exactly.
So it depresses them. And they begin to imagine the worst things.
That they'll get divorced.
Yeah, exactly. So it could be a sign that the parents don't love each other, don't love the children. And maybe sometimes even they feel that it's their fault that all this is happening.
Exactly.
You know, the arguments that the parents are doing so much for them, and now the child feels the lack of security. So this causes a depression and a lack of security among the children. And it could have damaging effects to the child as he grows up. And he would also begin thinking that this is a normal way of how couples should treat each other.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, when it would have a major, major effect on his own relationships also.
Exactly.
And he wouldn't treat, for example, or she wouldn't treat her husband, the wife, in the manner that Islam wants us to. So it's very important to be very careful of your husband or the parents between each other when you are confronting, when you are near the child.
Yeah.
You should have the seclusion that not near the child all these things should come up. Some parents also tell children to take sides.
Mm.
It's so bad. It gives such a bad effect that sometimes the wife feels that her husband is not treating her fairly. Yeah. So she may talk to the children and tell them the bad things.
Yeah.
Like it's a
make
very
them go against the father.
Yeah.
Instance.
And that will even affect the relationship between the children and the father in the long term.
Mm.
And they wouldn't be like to look upon, somebody to look upon as a father.
Exactly.
They would feel that the father always mistreated their mother. And that's a very bad thing, you know. There would be no respect and love for the father. And this happens when they're children. It's terrible when it happens when they're children, especially. Because it'll leave a mark in their hearts that the father is unfair on them. Or vice versa also.
Yeah.
Also, it happens when you deprive the children of love and respect for the extended families. It's a great wrong to tell them things about their aunts and uncles,
yeah.
To fill them up that so-and-so did so-and-so in this stage. And this is, and then they will not feel like doing Sile Rahmi. So it gives a big effect, you know, in their lives.
Yeah.
Because Sile Rahmi is a thing that is incumbent in Islam.
It's very
keeping
much.
Ties with your aunts and immediate family members.
It is very important for us to be careful with how we behave with our children about others as well.
Yeah, in front of the children, there are certain behaviors that should not be taken for granted.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, thank you very much. So we're going to take a short break, and inshallah, after the break, we're going to continue this discussion.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your audience to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing.
Another mistake that a parent often makes is that she has or he has wrong expectations from the child. Maybe they expect too much from him, beyond his capacity, beyond his age limit. Some parents would like their children to behave totally like adults.
Yeah.
Especially when they take them out, they feel that the child should be pin drop silence.
Shouldn't dirty things.
Exactly. Especially if they are small.
Mm.
Or if they are a bit big and they say silly comments, the child says no. Don't say anything when you're outside.
The parents
again
the child,
killing their self-esteem, as we talked about earlier. So they don't want them to run around, to play, to talk loudly, touch things around the house, and they don't understand, they fail to realize that all these activities are part of growing up.
Yeah.
To be a healthy adult, a child needs to have passed these various stages, each of which is a building block in his character.
Exactly.
You know, that determine the other characters. It's like a building block. If that is not formed properly, the later things don't come in properly. They don't fit in properly. So in this regard, I would like to mention a hadith by Mufazzal, our sixth imam, describes the wisdom behind the childish behavior, which some adults dislike.
Mm.
It's very nice to reflect upon this hadiths of Mufazzal, because they are to deal with creation and why a child behaves childishly, for example.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the parents don't, they have so many expectations from the child. So this is why a child behaves childishly, the reason.
Wow.
That if a child had been born with mature intellect, he would have been astounded on opening his eyes and seeing such a varied assortment,
yeah.
a variety of assortment, different kinds of forms and distinctive images of unity and disunity. For a long time, he would not understand where he came from and where he arrived, and whether all that he was seeing was in a state of dream or wakefulness.
Oh.
If he had been born with mature intellect, this is still the hadith,
yeah.
he would have felt disgusted and degraded on feeling himself being carried about in the lap, fed with milk, and wrapped in, for example,
cloth.
Pampers,
oh, okay.
bandages. He would feel disgusted about it. He would say that, no, I wouldn't, because he would be able to rationalize, yeah?
yeah.
He would feel ashamed.
Feel shy.
But a child is a child, you see? They would not have been, if they had been born with mature intellect, that sweetness, nor that consideration for infants in the minds of adults which come from fondling the untutored child. The sweetness and the innocence wouldn't be there anymore. Their artlessness creates a particular attraction. As such, he is born into the world without an understanding for anything, quite unaware of the world and what lies therein. He views all these things with his undeveloped brain and inadequate understanding, and so does not feel perplexed.
Mm.
He doesn't feel, he's so, you know, like normal doing his activities, whilst the parents here feels that, you know, ashamed, feeling ashamed in front of others. She shouldn't. A parent should feel, in fact, take him to places where she knows she wouldn't be, you know, like told off.
Yeah.
Especially when a child has this habit of touching things. Choose your places where to go. Go with the, you know, in houses where parents have children.
Yeah.
Not in parents that they decorate their houses in such a way that you can't even touch one item.
Exactly.
Another phrase of the hadith says that his intellect and understanding develop by degrees, slowly from time to time, little by little. This introduces him gradually to the things around him, and then accustoms his brain accordingly to grow up and to accept everything around him.
It's like Allah has planned this all.
Yes,
know?
Yes, it's planned. It.
Okay, thank you very much. We are just going to take a short break, and after the break, we're going to continue this discussion. Thank you. Stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "He who has a child must treat him in a childish manner."
Okay, so you're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. So what are the other wrong expectations we have from kids?
Yes, there are many wrong expectations that sometimes we as adults have towards our kids, and that messes about everything. And for example, the child lives in a world quite different from ours, and their perspective is different, you know, and it's very important for themselves also. So if you meddle with them, you know, their perspective, we may ruin things altogether. For example, if we don't allow a child to have a little of his own independence,
yeah.
to, you know, meddle with things that he's interested in, for example. If the consequences are not very destructive, I mean, we should give him the chance to investigate for himself, and, you know, his inquisitive nature, like, demands it, that
Definitely.
He should experience and learn, right?
Yeah.
That children like learning through experience, and themselves too. So we should try to give them that much space, you know, so that they can experience and learn. But if you become so rigid and so, you know, disciplinary attitude, you know, then,
yeah.
then they wouldn't learn so fast, and they wouldn't even learn how to make their own decisions in future.
Very
so those
true.
Are the mistakes adults do, by thinking that the children are so disciplined, whilst that is not the real thing wanted from the children.
I think they feel like this is this is in fact what's good, that, you know, trying to be disciplined and making sure our kids from a young age, if they learn to be like this, then, you know, when they grow up, they'll be perfect, you know.
Yeah, they don't know that this will actually do more harm than good.
Yeah, exactly.
It's good to give some flexibility in their life.
Mm.
A small thing shouldn't be treated like a major issue, you know.
Yeah.
So parents should be wise enough to think over this matter and not to, you know, make the children feel that they are so much in a, like a restricted.
Yeah, they should try and put themselves in their children's shoes.
Yeah, like sometimes, you know, it happens when you want to go out, for example, and you give this rigid behavior in the child's mind that you have to behave this way.
Yeah.
You don't have to move. You have to sit beside me. Otherwise, I'll pinch you from the back and things like that. It was practiced in our times way back, and parents who brought up the children in that era till now, unfortunately, I hear parents saying that so-and-so children are so naughty. They can't sit in one place. They don't know children are.
Exactly.
They are supposed to move, investigate, be happy. And the sawab goes to the parent who feels that, no, let them be given space.
Yeah,
to.
I think the older times people, they feel like we are doing a mistake if we let the children, you know, have their own space. They feel like, no, then they're not going to be nurtured properly. They're not going to be disciplined.
Yeah.
Then you have to scold them sometimes. You have to be rigid with them. But because they don't know, you know, now that we've got more experience,
yeah.
We're learning more, we're understanding that this is, in fact, a necessity for a child, you know.
And they don't want to listen also. They want to just stick to their views, unfortunately.
Exactly.
But these are the wrong expectations to have from children. I mean, I feel that now that knowledge has progressed so much, books are so much, you know, like at our disposal. So such grandparents also should think about it and should read and should come with terms with the fact that these are wrong expectations to have from the child. That if you take the child out, he should be so, you know, well-mannered and things like that. And they translate well-mannered into sitting into one place and not, you know, asking questions or not talking a little loudly, for example.
Yeah.
We hush them off. And
unfortunately, then, like, when there are those children who are disciplined and there are those who are naughty, they would turn to the discipline and say, look, these are so,
exactly.
You know, perfect. And what's wrong with, you know,
and like then there's a gap always, like, you know, in those children.
Mm.
They feel a bit complexed.
That if you are not good enough.
We are not good enough. Or, you know, it gives less self-esteem than the required, that Islam wants a lot of confidence, a lot of self-respect.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. Dear audience, thank you for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Inshallah, until the next program, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The United States has been waging a brutal campaign of economic warfare against Iran, also known as the Maximum Pressure Campaign. These sanctions have had a devastating effect on the country's economy and civilian population. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. In 2015, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran Nuclear Deal, was signed by Iran and the P5 plus one, meaning the United States, the UK, France, China, Russia, plus Germany. This agreement set out the framework whereby sanctions against Iran would be lifted in exchange for Iran curbing its nuclear capabilities. And indeed, Iran complied fully with the agreement. This was verified by the United Nations nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency. And in 2016, all oil and financial sanctions were lifted, releasing almost $100 billion to Iran in frozen assets. However, in 2018, Donald Trump unilaterally pulled the United States out of the Iran nuclear deal, claiming that Iran was violating the agreement. This, of course, was not true, and no one shared this view, not the United States' own European allies, nor the international inspectors from the IAEA. The Trump regime then moved to reimpose crippling sanctions targeting Iran's oil sector, aircraft exports, precious metals, construction imports, and financial transactions. What the Trump regime wanted was to renegotiate the deal with Iran in order to dismantle Iran's ballistic missile program and to stop Iran from supporting resistance efforts in the Middle East. Effectively, what the United States did here is go back on its own word, not even 3 years after striking this deal, and then with such overt and brazen greed proceed to ask for even more concessions. This proves that there never really was an existential threat or fear of Iran obtaining a nuclear bomb like we heard so often and still do. What Washington wants is for Tehran to abandon its ballistic missiles program because this benefits Israel and Saudi Arabia. Moreover, Washington would love to limit Tehran and contain Iran's influence in the region, preventing Iran from fighting the illegal occupation of Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq by the Zionists and the Americans. So, of course, the United States resorts to lies, to propaganda, and ridiculous smears using the mainstream media as its vehicle, which reminded me of the days in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003 when they were constantly talking about weapons of mass destruction, 24/7. Now they have a new slogan, a new catchphrase, but for Iran, where they say, Iran is the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism, and they try to use that in order to justify their imperialist aggression and conquest. Iran is no stranger to U.S. sanctions, but the Trump administration has been running what it calls the maximum pressure campaign, led by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. This maximum pressure campaign is designed to exert as much pressure and wreak as much havoc as possible on the economies of countries that the United States has targeted for regime change, just like Iran, just like Syria, Venezuela, and this always results in widespread suffering and death for the civilian population. Simply put, this is economic terrorism. This is a modern version of siege warfare, and it is cruel, it is inhumane, and it is illegal under international law. After leaving the JCPOA, we've seen the United States slap Iran with new sanctions almost every week. The U.S. has been so adamant in trying to put new sanctions on Iran that it even tried to trigger snapback sanctions at the United Nations Security Council earlier this year in August, and bring back this UN arms embargo that consequently expired in October. This motion failed miserably, and it was a huge diplomatic embarrassment for the United States. Out of the 15 members who sit on the UN Security Council, the United States and the Dominican Republic were the only ones who voted for the resolution, with the other 13 members either voting against it or abstaining. This desperation was made even more obvious by the fact that the U.S.'s own allies, France, the UK, and Germany, abstained from the vote. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Kelly Craft, insisted that they would be re-implementing UN sanctions on Iran, despite the UN not being on board and voting the resolution down. There were no UN sanctions returning on Iran. The arms embargo expired. But because there is such a lack of international support in order to save face, that's what they've been saying, and it just proves how pathetic and farcical this entire campaign is. Just to further underscore how ardent the U.S. has been in its pursuit of economic warfare against Iran, Donald Trump's National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien, even said that the U.S. has imposed so many sanctions on Iran that there's, quote, very little left for us to do. Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif tweeted a few days ago, quite accurately, I might add, that the United States is addicted to sanctions. I think it's putting it mildly. Just to further underscore this sustained campaign of aggression against Iran, not only did the U.S. pull out of the JCPOA, it also assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The U.S. then flew a drone into Iranian airspace, violating Iran's sovereignty, and then issued a rebuke in response when Iran shot down, rightfully so, their unmanned aircraft. They've also threatened to pirate Iranian shipments of fuel to Venezuela, who's also struggling under brutal sanctions by the U.S. And in a separate incident, we also saw U.S. jets harass a civilian commercial airliner from Mahan Air that was flying over Lebanese airspace. These provocations are no accident and have been designed to complement this maximum pressure campaign. Nonetheless, the implications are not all military. The results of these sanctions can be felt in all areas of life. What the United States and their allies would like you to believe is that sanctions are some kind of harmless tool, a dull blade wielded in order to exert political pressure. But the reality on the ground is that scores of civilians end up starving and suffering and dying at the hands of these brutal sanctions, this economic terrorism. Let's call it for what it is. We've seen this before when the U.S. killed untold numbers of children in Iraq with sanctions in the early 90s. We're seeing this right now in Syria with the brutal Caesar Act sanctions, causing people to wait in breadlines in a country that was once self-sufficient in food. We're seeing this in Venezuela where people have no fuel and nothing to eat. 40,000 people minimum have died already because of U.S. sanctions. And we're seeing this now as well in Iran. We're seeing the effect there as well, where people are forced to go without medicine during a pandemic. Iran's health minister, Namaki, said earlier this month that the sanctions imposed on Iran by the U.S. have targeted medicine and medical equipment. Now, even though the United States claims its sanctions don't target things like medicine or medical supplies or food, European and other international partners end up being dissuaded from trading with Iran out of fear of retaliation and being slapped with secondary sanctions. In October of this year, the United States moved to sanction Iran's entire financial sector, blacklisting 18 of its banks, shutting it out completely of global markets and making it extremely difficult for businesses and, more importantly, for the government to buy medicine and medical supplies. How can countries like the United States and the United Kingdom profess to be liberal democracies who uphold international law and oppose tyranny when they are responsible for murdering scores of innocent civilians with their barbaric siege warfare? Never mind the wars, never mind the bombings, the drone strikes, the invasions. It seems that their idea of bringing democracy to others entails starving off entire populations and putting them through unspeakable misery. The fact that one would do this at any time is cruel enough. But the fact that the United States has not only continued these sanctions, but increased them during a global pandemic further exposes how brutal their foreign policy is and further proves this point. The United Nations and numerous other international bodies have all called on the U.S. to end its brutal sanctions, to end this ridiculous maximum pressure campaign amid the coronavirus crisis, calls that the United States has completely and utterly ignored. The sanctions are so severe that they have spurred the growth of a black market, leaving Iranians without medicines that they desperately need or being forced to pay obscene amounts just to obtain them. How can anyone justify such economic and medical terrorism? We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me now to talk more is Dr. Said Sarkar, Professor of Medical Physics at Tehran University of Medical Sciences. Thank you for coming on, Professor. I wanted to ask you, the United States claims that its sanctions don't target humanitarian goods like medicines and food. How have U.S. sanctions impacted Iran's ability to obtain drugs, medical equipment, and medical supplies?
The U.S. sanction really has paralyzed the Iranian health sector. When they try to buy some special equipment or some pharmaceuticals or devices for patients, they are not able to do so. Although they say there is no sanction on health sector, but anyway, we cannot transfer money because all the sanctions through on the Iranian banks, which are not able to transfer money to the companies who they from they buy their facilities. Is that somehow that they say, okay, you are allowed to buy things or get hold of these pharmaceuticals, they block the way. So it's untouchable or unreachable, because if you want to buy them, you have to pay them, pay the companies. And also, the companies are worried after they say they will be punished by the U.S. Authorities. This is really terrible. This sanction has paralyzed us and has a profound effect on our health sector, and really people are suffering from these sanctions, and they have taken the Iranian nation as economic hostage, and really they are blackmailing Iranian population to impose their will on our nation.
I believe President Rouhani also said that these U.S. sanctions are preventing Iran from obtaining a COVID vaccine from the World Health Organization. Could you elaborate on that for us?
Yes, that's right. They have been trying to buy this COVID vaccine from several weeks ago, and unfortunately, they have not been able to transfer money to pay for the cost of these vaccines. And also, as I mentioned, these companies are really worried about the punishment which will follow business with Iran. This is a bunch of lies that they deliver. And I don't know the American policymaker, especially President Trump, they are saying that there is no sanction on the health sector, but in reality, we cannot do anything regarding our health sector.
So, Professor, how has Iran managed to cope despite the sanctions? What is Iran doing? What kind of innovations have we seen coming out of this crisis?
At the beginning, we had a lot of problems providing PPE and also ventilators and other necessary consumables and drugs for our patients that really was hurting. But we are not going to sit and surrender. And somehow we thought that we should do something about it. And fortunately, especially our knowledge-based companies, started their R&D activities. And through technology development, we overcome some of these problems. For example, regarding facial masks, N95, things we had the technology on nanofiber technology. We were able, using nanofiber technology, to produce N95 and even N99 facial masks. At the beginning, our production capacity was about 20,000 masks per day, but fortunately, within 2 weeks, we increased our production capacity in 200,000 masks per day, because we had the technology and we were producing the industrial machinery and the production done. And Iran is one of the few countries who have the technology to build up this nanofiber technology, which makes us capable of producing N95 masks. And we are producing all hand sanitizers using nanomaterial like nanosilver particles or titanium oxide particles, and also we are producing air purification. And top scientists managed to make a system for detection of COVID patients. It's called the RDS, ROS detector, and within less than 30 seconds, using these nanosensors to detect those who are affected with COVID-19 virus. They dip the nanosensor inside the sputum. If the person is affected with the virus, within 30 seconds, the system will be able to detect the ROS, which is a byproduct of virus in the lung. So the patients who have lung infection inflammation. Mm-hmm. I mean, by the virus, this system will immediately detect them.
And Iran has been developing its own COVID vaccine, correct?
Several Iranian companies are engaged in developing COVID-19 vaccine. Several of them are using weak virus or the kill virus. But two of these companies are using the edge of the technology, what the technology, and also nanolipid particles to produce vaccines like what BioNTech and Pfizer or Moderna use the technology. And we hope that within next 6 months, we will be able to start vaccination in Iran by Iranian-made vaccine, the top range of the technology. And fingers crossed, some of the companies have passed even an animal trial, mm-hmm. and we need to do the clinical trial on people. And hopefully, we will be able to provide our people with Iranian-made vaccine.
In terms of regular medicines and medication, how much harder have they become to obtain? And how have U.S. sanctions impacted that?
Regarding the regular medicine, we don't have much of the problem because Iranian industry, pharmaceutical industry, is capable of producing ordinary or regular drugs. But regarding special drugs special patients in cancer or like hemophilia or some other special disease, there are severe effects on these groups of patients, which they cannot really find these drugs in pharmacies, and they need to go to black market and pay several times more to buy these drugs. So this is really hurting and has put a severe pressure on these innocent patients regarding, this is the result of what the U.S. doing with the ordinary people. And, it's really unbearable.
Doctor, thank you so much for your time and for all your hard work. I really appreciate having you on the show. Thank you so much. The effects of these sanctions on Iran's economy are also undeniable. Just last month, Mike Pompeo was even bragging about how the U.S. has crippled Iran's economy by devaluing its currency, the rial, increasing public debt and inflation, and reducing the number of barrels of oil that the country is able to export. The fact that we regularly see the U.S. Secretary of State gloat about this exposes a shameless imperialist arrogance, how these imperialists are proud of causing the death and destruction of others. And it's important to note how everything is interconnected. Again, while the United States pretends that its sanctions don't target humanitarian goods, this is a flat-out lie and a denial of the reality on the ground and the suffering of countless people that is inflicted by the United States and their allies. Now that Joe Biden has been officially declared the president-elect by the Electoral College, one must ponder what lies next in terms of sanctions with the incoming Biden administration. Biden was vice president, after all, under Obama when the Iran nuclear deal, when the JCPOA was negotiated, and reaffirmed earlier this month in an interview with the New York Times that the U.S. would rejoin the deal if Iran adheres to the agreement. Once again, this is a bit of a nonsensical statement because Iran has always adhered to the agreement and protocols of the JCPOA, whereas the United States did not and tore up the deal. So it's frankly ridiculous that the U.S. expects something from Iran. It's on the U.S. to show some goodwill and prove that they can engage in long-lasting diplomacy, not the other way around. It's worth noting that we've seen calls from Germany and the United States that they want to renegotiate the Iran nuclear deal, calling it a nuclear deal plus. But these are all iterations of the same thing. What they want is what Trump originally said, which is to curb Iran's ballistic missile program and to contain Iran's influence in the region and to stop it from resisting against the Zionists and American occupations. That's what it comes down to. They're all going back on what they originally agreed to, which is utterly absurd. Iran has made it absolutely clear that they will not renegotiate the nuclear deal. I mean, why should they? The P5 plus one couldn't even follow the original nuclear deal. Iran did, and was treated with disdain in return. So as long as there's a clear understanding between the two sides that the sanctions are lifted, then perhaps there will be a return to some sort of normalcy in that regard. However, what a lot of media stenographers and some of the U.S. own allies are saying is that they want to renegotiate this deal, get rid of Iran's nuclear capabilities and ballistic missile program, and cripple the access of resistance. This is off the table, and that's not happening. After the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Dr. Fakhrizadeh last month, the Iranian parliament passed a draft resolution that sets out to enrich more of Iran's uranium up to 20%, which is much higher than the 3.67% set out in the JCPOA, and to beef up its nuclear program in 2 months' time. That time frame is no accident. What they're doing is essentially giving the Biden administration a chance to see if they'll lift any of the sanctions before actually going ahead with it. Now, President Rouhani has expressed concerns about the draft resolution and said earlier this week that he has no doubt the U.S. will rejoin the Iran nuclear deal and lift all the sanctions. Iran's leader also addressed the topic of sanctions in a televised statement this week. He said there are two ways to tackle sanctions. Number one is removing them. Number two is to nullify and overcome them. He said that Iran tried the first option, tried removing sanctions by negotiating for a few years, but to no use. The second option, he said, may have difficulties in the beginning, but will have a favorable end. And indeed, that does seem to be what Iran has been doing. You know, what the United States and its Treasury Department did not consider is that Iran does not rely solely on oil. Iran has a very diverse economy with many means to fall back on and is able to barter and still navigate around the sanctions with other allies in the region and internationally. Even though the economy is in a bad shape because of the sanctions and people are suffering and dying, it is still a mark of resilience. And the country has been able to withstand sanctions, not just now, but for the last 40 years. This is something that Iranians, Syrians, and other peoples targeted by the U.S. empire know all too well. The United States thinks that it can cripple these countries and slowly choke off their resources. But ironically, it ends up forcing them to adopt self-sufficiency, bringing them closer to each other, increasing cooperation, and letting them find new intuitive ways to deal with the harsh measures imposed on them. Venezuela, for example, which has also been targeted by this maximum pressure campaign and that's economic terrorism from the U.S., was able to fulfill its fuel needs by trading directly with Iran. Even Iran's defense capabilities have proven to be formidable, especially for a country under economic duress. Just this August, we saw Iran unveil two new missiles, a cruise missile named after the martyred Abu Mahdi Mohandes, and a ballistic missile named after the martyred Haj Qasem. Despite these brutal sanctions, we've seen Iran develop its own COVID-19 testing, working on its own vaccine. We've seen Iran helping Syria in its fight against the foreign-backed terrorists sent by the West. We've also seen Iran send aid to its brothers in Venezuela, who are also engaged in the fight against Western imperialism and suffering under the same brutal sanctions. Even in public infrastructure, just look at how Iran is doing better than the country sanctioning it, the United States, which is supposedly the richest nation on earth. Once again, through its imperialist foreign policy, the United States exposes itself as incapable of engaging in genuine substantive diplomacy based on mutual respect and cooperation. Instead, the U.S. prefers to engage in conquest, siege warfare, economic terrorism, subjecting millions of people around the globe to inhumane and crippling sanctions. But if anything, this has shown Iran to be resilient and strong and capable of enduring even in the face of adversity. And Iran remains steadfast in its fight against imperialism along with its brothers in Syria and Venezuela and the Global South, and they will not be defeated. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is
For a Better Life.
For a Better Life.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome once again to another program of For a Better Life. In this program, dear brothers and sisters, I will be talking about Islamic business ethics. It is sometimes said that business ethics is evil. How can one do business and still be an ethical person? Isn't business all about self-interest, greed, and making a lot of profits? Yes, it is true that the physical earthly dimension of a human is based on two main characteristics. Number one, greed, and number two, anger. The former attracts whatever it perceives to be beneficial, and the latter repels whatever it perceives to be harmful. But the spiritual, heavenly dimension of business ethics consists of mind and conscience. Mind and conscience, dear brothers and sisters, which have the potential of controlling the elements of greed and anger. Because it was greed and anger who took 20 to 80 million of our African brothers and put them into slavery and shipped them in those horrible means, on those horrible ways, horrible behaviors that those slave masters had, shipped them to North and South of America in the great cross-Atlantic slave trade. 20 to 80 million Africans who suffered immensely, and not talking about those millions of Africans who died and perished in the Atlantic Ocean. It was greed and anger who led to colonization and colonized countries for 300 years with people, deprived those nations from their wealth. We deprived those people from their own wealth and made ourselves richer, all in the sake and name of profits. We shipped slaves in horrendous ways to the North and South of America, and we shipped potatoes and other objects like fish and food items to Europe on the way back. All of this in the name of profit. When profit is checked with greed and anger, this is what you get. This is the outcome. We colonized Vietnam. Later on, when they kicked out the French, US came in and we killed and massacred and genocide 3 million Vietnamese, all in the name of natural sources. Greed and anger, when it is unchecked, when we do not have conscience, we do not feel any conscience, then that can lead us to dangerous path which will only inflict suffering upon nations and people. And still today we see this greed, where we are using human beings as just mechanical tools, digits, a number. We're just using them as we are using robots in huge billion-dollar corporations, all in the name of profit. So when we add the adjective Islamic to business ethics, it might surprise some. But one has to realize that Islam is more than just a religion in the spiritual sense of the word. It is a way of life. It embraces, it encompasses all the dimensions of human life. And one of them is business.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. Charity to the poor. ourselves, we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
There is no difference between the sphere of worship and the sphere of business. Islamic laws govern the family life of Muslims as well as they do when it comes to social conduct. And the foundation of Islamic business ethics depends on the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet. This earth, dear brothers and sisters, is our abode. It is our home. This earth and its surrounding atmosphere have the resources to sustain our lives on it. But as you can see, because of greed and anger, we have demolished our atmosphere, we have demolished our ozone, we have demolished our environment, we have sound, air, plastic, vision, pollution, all of these different kinds of pollution. When it comes to sound pollution, air pollution, you have vision pollution, all of it because of greed and anger. Even look at our farms. Some farms do not believe in the free-range chicken or free-range cows or free-range sheep. They just put them in a factory and they are forced to stand day in and day out and eat genetic modified food. And the lights are modified. So they turn off the lights so they sleep earlier, and then they turn on the lights so they wake up earlier, so that they produce more and more. These are not healthy food items. We are destroying our atmosphere and our environment from all different aspects. And we have to do something about it. When you have ethics in business, dear brothers and sisters, we can develop green economy systems. We can develop a green environment. We can develop a renewable energy system. We can develop green technology, renewable energy, and so on and so forth, without demolishing or at least having the least footprint on Earth. So we have to control greed and anger. Satan is our enemy and will try his best to misguide us. Divine guidance will come to us and we are expected to follow it. The life on this earth is for a fixed time only. We have to have death in front of us. Think about death. You should daily, as a Muslim, think about death. Not in a way that you get depression, no. You think about death and then you will rectify your actions. The hereafter is the final destination. When you have the hereafter in your mind, when you brush your teeth, when you go and play basketball or handball or football, when you go to your job, you have the hereafter in your sight, that will help you to correct your deeds, to rectify your deeds. The hereafter is the final destination. Whether the final destination will be blissful or painful depends on you, whether or not we are following the divine guidance. So in Islam, we say that the human being is Khalifatullah fil ard. The human being is the vicegerency, the steward of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on the earth. And one of the responsibilities of it is to have ethics in all the dimensions of our lives.